House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is an informational hearing on a couple of issues. The first one is requires corrections officers to report abuse of inmates to the Oregon Department of Corrections. Brian Lathan, please.
I know.
Would it be okay if I bring up my assistant Elijah Brown?
Yes, sir.
May we be seated?
Yes, please. And then you can speak in any order. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Brian Lathan. I'm an attorney here in Salem, Oregon. Have been since 2004.
I'm Elijah Brown. I'm an assistant to Brian Lathan.
Elijah will be going to law school in the fall, and he's helped me out on several cases against Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I started handling cases shortly after becoming an attorney regarding sexual abuse that has happened to female inmates there. Represented over 25 women at the facility. Currently, I represent 9. Lawsuits have been filed, and they pertain to abuse, some by corrections officers in the past, but others by employees of the state. And I'm here to support Senate Bill 417. I don't know if you want any other information than that to start off, or?
Just whatever information you want to give us would be fine. That's what we're trying to find out a little bit more about this.
Well, part of it, as you're trying to get more information about it, in 2012, the state settled with about 17 sexual abuse victims in litigation. Cost the state over $1.6 million in resolving those claims. None of them went to trial that I'm aware of. I represented the majority of those individuals. The Oregonian did a big write-up on it regarding kind of a code of silence, the culture there at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility at that time. When I first started, and the reason why I think Senate Bill 417 is so important, when I first started, I asked several questions during depositions on what do you do to, I asked a corrections officer, okay, so if you see something that you think is abuse, what do you do? What are you instructed to do? And they told me time and time again, well, I'm instructed to go talk to that individual, the correction officer, talk to that person and tell them to self-report. And they had no duty or obligation to tell anyone. It was just go talk. This is what they're told. Okay, Mr. Jones or Officer Jones, I suspect you of abusing this person. Please report yourself. And that's how it was handled. What I like about this bill is that it talks about this mandatory reporting if they see something suspicious that could lead or could be abuse. And I think that would help a lot to protect the women that are incarcerated there at Coffee Creek. Being women, they are very vulnerable and susceptible to abuse. The majority of the employees there are males. And I think this would help add an extra layer of protection to those women if Senate Bill 417 is passed.
Okay. Any questions from the panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leonard Williamson.
May I be seated?
Please.
Thank you.
Just wait before you start, remember to identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Leonard Williamson, and presently I'm employed as the Oregon Department of Corrections Inspector General. The Inspector General's office was created in 1990 after the murder of Director Steve Franke. It came as a result of Judge Warden's report about alleged allegations of corruptions in the Department of Corrections. The primary purpose of that office is to investigate not only corruption, but misconduct, crimes, staff malfeasance. That's the primary focus of the office. We have roughly 60 employees in that office, a portion of which, roughly half, are dedicated to the investigation of misconduct within the walls of the prison system. Before I talk about that office further, though, I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1991. I was a criminal prosecutor in Tillamook County for 7 years. Left there to teach criminal law and criminal procedure at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I spent roughly 2.5 years there and then went to the Oregon Department of Justice, where I was in the trial division for the last 11 years. My primary responsibility there was the trial attorney for the Oregon Department of Corrections, handling the civil rights cases that were brought against the department, including those that involved misconduct of a sexual nature by staff on inmates. I left there as the managing attorney of the torts, employment, and civil rights section, and have been at the Department of Corrections for the last 20 months as its inspector general. The different manners in which inmates may report abuse of any kind fall into the following kinds of categories by which they can report. We have an internal grievance system. This system is outside the control of operations or corrections employees. It's a closed system and goes to the grievance coordinators so that when inmates submit complaints or concerns, they're funneled in a way that line officers don't see them if they're of a nature that involved a sexual allegation. We have an inspector general's hotline. The hotline number is completely confidential. Inmates call there and leave our office information about their concerns, all the way from whether or not they're complaining about crunchy peanut butter, all the way up to claims of sexual misconduct. We average somewhere between 40 and 60 calls a month on that hotline, and all of them are either investigated by our office or referred back out for additional information gathering to see what needs to be done. Additionally, with the new phone system that we implemented a year ago, inmates can call out on that in terms of collect calls, and I get calls at my desk from inmates that I take. They also use an informal communication system called Kites, where they send Kites and communications to my office that we investigate and report. We have a discrimination appeals process similar to the grievance system. We get letters from the governor's office where inmates have written to the governor's office, and we follow up and investigate those. We also have an email system where friends or family can email us. Inmates can pursue judicial remedies, whether it's a state habeas proceeding, small claims action, civil rights claims against the state. We, at each one of our institutions, we have sexual assault response teams, as well as rape compliance officers, so that if an inmate reports that, it's referred to that team. That team works with our office to investigate the claim. Inmates were allowed MP3 players with text messaging capability, and we get messages by text message from inmates now. We also, probably 6 to 8 times a year, take a team of 25 or 26 investigators out into the field. We search 300 to 600 cells looking for contraband, which is often a clue that something nefarious is going on, whether it's maybe staff bringing something in or other items are being smuggled in. As a result of that, we also then pull out and interview somewhere between 60 and 80 inmates to find out how they're doing, what's going on, if there's anything that they want from us or need from our office. We just did that 2 weeks ago at the Pendleton facility and the Two Rivers facility. We also have a memo of understanding with the Oregon State Police. We've had that in place for the last 5 years. Every time we get a call that an inmate has been sexually assaulted, we partner with the state police and they come out and assist us in that investigation. So that's by way of background about what the Inspector General's office does with abuse claims or sexual abuse claims, and I'm happy to answer questions further. I did bring some of the new hotline posters with us. They're printed in English and Spanish and all over the facilities. Those calls cost nothing. When the inmate picks up the phone, one of the first prompts that they hear is, if you want to call the Inspector General's office, just press 9. And a voicemail message is left with us, and then we follow up.
I have a question. So Mr. Lathan was talking about saying that the officers are told if they see something to go to the other officer first rather than report up. Is that still the policy?
Well, I understand his statement because I was the attorney assigned to roughly 12 of his cases and was involved in those depositions. My recollection of the policy and what we teach there is if you see something that you consider a red flag with respect to an employee, another employee, it's your duty to bring that to their attention. It's also your duty to make sure that if they don't report up, you then do that yourself, that you report up and up the chain of command and let somebody know that something's not right. So the buck doesn't stop there.
And I'm guessing here, so, you know, I'm assuming something. So I'm assuming I see something I think is wrong, so I go to Officer Prozanski and say, did I see what I think I saw, because, you know, and then he has an explanation of what took place. It is not what I thought it might be, but he can still let know that somebody thought there was something up.
Sure, and if you're not satisfied with the comment, the practice that we want staff to engage in is, well, let's go have a conversation with our supervisor then. Make sure that's clear. Maybe if somebody else saw it, we don't want a misunderstanding, because we could get down a roadway and somebody thinks right. Something else.
Okay.
That employee could also call our office.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. You're an attorney and I'm an attorney.
Yes, sir.
And we have 24/7 obligation to report child abuse.
Yes, we do.
And we're soon going to have that same obligation as it relates to elderly abuse. Question I have for you, is there a statutory obligation upon an employee of the Department of Corrections to report abuse by statute? And if the answer is no, is there any employment contractual relationship that requires abuse to be reported?
To my knowledge, there's not a statutory requirement. Now, there is the recently enacted federal legislation around the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Those specific requirements require our department to comply with certain components of that act, including reporting. So while that's not a law, I mean, it is a requirement. It's a requirement of the federal government that our department comply with those standards. There's not an Oregon statute to answer your question specifically. As to the department's policies, we do have policies in place that require employees to report the abuse. And I get those from employees all the time, whether it's a phone call or a letter or an email from an employee. Sometimes they send them from their home email address because they don't want to use the state system, but we still get them, and then we follow up and investigate them.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hicks, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the ratio of reports of sexual misconduct, abuse, harassment that result in formal action either by the department or criminal charges that are filed by the police?
I can get you that data, but let me just tell you anecdotally what I think that is. We probably average maybe 5 PREA calls a month that involve a claim of sexual abuse. And if the claim is one of sexual harassment versus sexual assault, the sexual harassment then would be investigated by our SART teams in our office.
Yep.
If the claim is one of sexual assault, then we call the state police, and our office partners with them in terms of the investigation. Now, those that are founded versus unfounded or criminally prosecuted versus not, I'd have to pull that data for you because I don't have it in the top of my head.
Okay.
And the willingness of prosecutors in our jurisdictions to pick those up and prosecute them, it depends on the locale and their resources.
And if I may ask another?
Yes, sure.
You've referenced now the Prison Rape Elimination Act, the PREA,
yes,
a couple times. The Oregon, my understanding is that Oregon is quite far ahead in terms of compliance, that we're sort of leading in many ways.
That's the feedback that we get from sister states when we do trainings with them, or we talk to national auditors that we're ahead of the curve. I couldn't tell you how far ahead or not.
And Mr. Chair,
please go ahead.
Okay, and so does the Prison Rape Elimination Act, the PREA, provide for anything along the lines of what Senate Bill 417 would propose in terms of, I mean, what does the act contemplate, if anything, in regards to what correction duties corrections officers do or do not have?
It's a
report.
It's a different structure. So, for example, presently the way an abuse claim would get investigated is just as I described. We would, if it was one of sexual harassment, our office would do the investigation. And we may involve our own SART teams in that investigation. If it's one of sexual assault or sexual abuse, our office then works with the state police. We develop the case and then present it to the district attorney's office. Versus this bill, which suggests that all of those would be reviewed by the attorney general's office. So we go to a local prosecutor or local law enforcement to deal with that that jurisdictional issue. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's the way I see it as being different. The other difference I think is important to note. Under the new federal PREA standards, the Department of Corrections will be audited, not by ourselves, but by a independent team of federal auditors that will report to our governor's office. And based on that audit, we're either in compliance or we're not.
Oh, can I just one more?
Yeah, yes.
So you're basically saying it's going to be a results-oriented analysis that the feds use to keep the PREA compliance funds coming?
I suspect so.
Okay.
What we understand, the audit standards only came out about 3 weeks ago. So it's kind of a evolving understanding of what those will look like. However, it's a pass-fail. It's not 80%. It's not 70%. It's a pass-fail.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Williamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Williamson. And for the record, we are not related. How is data collected? Where do you collect and store data on these complaints? And how are they dealt with internally? How is data collection dealt with internally?
Well, there are two data collection sources. One is the Offender Management Information System, or called OMS.
Mm-hmm.
So every PREA-related complaint, whether it's one of sexual assault or sexual harassment, that data is entered into that database. That database isn't that old. It's just a couple years old. Now, the investigations office that I run has an access database with respect to the investigations that it does. It's not as nimble as the OMS database. So every single report, regardless of outcome, gets entered into our investigations database. We have recently upgraded to a new product that will probably come online sometime this summer.
Great, thank you.
Follow up.
In the data that you're collecting, are you seeing any, or what differences are you seeing between men and women inmates and claims that, or allegations of claims that they're bringing to you?
You know, I'm not able to answer that from a data perspective. I can tell you what my gut tells
That'd
me about
great.
It. Much like in the early 90s as a criminal prosecutor, we thought we were experiencing an explosion of child sex abuse cases at that point. And really what was happening is we were doing a better job of figuring out how to communicate around those issues, and they were just coming to light more. I think the same is true now of what's going on with respect to sexual assault in prisons. And it's a result of starting in 2003 when the feds first came out with PREA and said, here's the direction we're headed. You need to start getting up to speed. You need to start figuring out how to report this. So it's kind of ballooned a little bit as a result of us creating an environment where it's easier to report. Now, based on my experience with these cases, I think that probably we hear more about the female inmates being abused than we do the male inmates. We have male inmates that are abused by staff, female staff. We're prosecuting one out in Pendleton. And so I think it occurs probably the same number as they do up at Coffee Creek. They're just not well-known or well-reported.
And I have one final question, Mr. Chair. Are there any policy differences between cases that deal with male inmates versus female inmates? Or are the policies the same?
I think each one of those may present its unique own circumstances, and here's why. Coffee Creek is a isolated universe in the sense of we don't have another women's facility. So if you have an allegation and you're not yet at a point where you have sufficient information to prosecute an employee criminally, the ability to move the inmate around within the facility to have some barrier between the employee and the staff member is constrained by the physical environment. And we do the best that we can in terms of changing work assignments or changing housing assignments for the female offender. In the male system, we have another 11 prisons to work with in terms of moving the offender somewhere or moving the employee to one of the other prisons to work at. Does that get at your question? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have two different databases, one from the federal, one from your own. Are those searchable in ways that you can see trends, whether it's a particular inmate, for example, is making a lot of claims, or whether it's a particular officer who is being identified by multiple people, so that even if they each one of them individually comes up and you not enough evidence so you don't do anything, are there any ways for you, and do you look at that to see if there's something going on that maybe never hasn't reached to the point of being a crime, but is something we should take notice and deal with?
I would say that the information that we have access to doesn't trend that way. And being a former defense attorney, that kind of data is really important to me, right, to be able to look at trending by facility. And so this new database that I was speaking of earlier will allow us to separate and segment claims that we investigate not only by facility but by type. Now, we do have complete access to an offender's file anytime that we want it, and it's going to show us their reports, all of their discipline matters, any kites, all that kind of information. It's just not in a data form where you can manipulate it and get what you're talking about.
Follow up,
please.
Because, from being in a school system for a long time, a lot of times the people who are in charge, like your position, move. And so there's no history that's kept other than the history that's in those files. And if they're not usable in that way,
right,
you lose a lot every time someone moves on. And I would assume in the corrections institutions we have lots of movement as well, which creates a loss of institutional history around those kinds of things. So I'm happy to hear that the new system actually will give you opportunities to do it, because I think that we have tried to do that better in other places now, and I hope that there's a chance to see if there are trends that could help us identify and deal with problems in the future. Thanks.
I have a follow-up question to that. Please. So if the new system allows you to look at trends from an offender perspective, and now you have access to an offender's file, do you have the ability to look at trends around a corrections officer or who the allegations are being made against?
Thank you for that question. So the new database that we're moving towards is searchable by offender and by employee name. So for example, any witness that we took a statement from, or whether or not they were the target of the investigation, the system will let me search by that person, whether they are a witness or accused.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the informational hearings. I'm reporting at the Corrections Department and open a informational hearing on House Bill 2581 that would change the tort claim notice and allow wrongful death claims and workers' compensation. Mike Sahogian.
Yes, Chair, Mike Sahogian, President.
I'm sorry. Please come on up. And Representative Witt.
Would you like Representative Witt to go first? I'm not.
Please. You, yeah, please. You both get set up there. It's fine.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Przanski.
Wherever you went.
I still wish him good afternoon. First of all, I'm a little discombobulated. I actually got this call 2 days ago to be here, and I had a hearing in Judge Raines in Washington County Circuit Court that was scheduled to last till noon today, and of course it lasted 12:15. So since 12:15, I've been on the road from Hillsborough here to Macon.
Reverend, identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Mike Sahagian. I'm an attorney in private practice. I've been in private practice for about 30 years. What brings me here, and I've been here one other time to testify, is on May 20th, 2012, Jennifer Warren was murdered when she was delivering medication to a person who was under the care or under the control of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB. The information I've handed out to you, the members of here today in the House have already received this, but I want them to have it again to refresh their memory. You have two documents I've put in front of you. One is the Oregonian article showing her mother testifying at this gentleman's sentencing, and he already has pled guilty but insane and is back under the PSRB's jurisdiction again. The second article, or the second attachment, is an article from Steve Dean, an Oregonian, and he's done a really nice job, I think, of outlining why this law needs to be corrected. And you may note his very last paragraph there talks about, basically, you know, it's up to the legislature, and that's why we're all here today. In a nutshell, after this lady was murdered, it came to light that she had been sent out by an agency she worked for, and the agency had been told previously by other employees, we're not going out there by ourselves with this gentleman because he's already been convicted of trying to murder his own mother. She went out there anyway by herself, and they found her later that day stabbed to death in the person's bathtub. When the estate sought to bring a claim, we found out quickly that there is a statute, there's a loophole in the statute that says if you're on the job and if somebody from any government entity or employee has caused you your death, the government entity has the same protection as the employer does and falls under the workers' comp purview. With that in mind, this estate got approximately, and I'm giving you ballpark figures, approximately about $15,000 for their funeral expenses and so forth. We can't make a claim for anything else. She has a 23-year-old daughter who just had a grandchild, We can make no further claims. In this House Bill 2581, there's been two amendments put in place, and that's what we're supporting. The first amendment would simply say, for wrongful death claims, it does not open the floodgates for anybody else who's been hurt and they're on the job by a government employee. For wrongful death claims, that would allow this claim to be made. And again, I want to stress that. That's clear because, again, if she had just been injured, her workers' comp would cover her medical bills. It would cover her lost wages, all those things. Because she was killed, that's all the state can claim. That's the first point. The second point is, in the second amendment to this House bill, is because of the situation we're in, we of course need to make it retroactive back to the date before this accident, or this accident, intentional murder. I had it written down, and I'm sure you folks are familiar with it. I don't have the name in front of me, but I know there's been a bit of a precedent already this session where there was a police officer, a corrections officer, who was killed and was 6 months short of his benefits, and he was allowed to, the statute was changed to allow him to basically go retroactive or at least advance that so he get the full compensation. That's kind of what we're doing here. We're simply asking to go back to May of 2012, make this amendment retroactive that day, and then, of course, we'll be able to make the claim. And that's all it allows us to do is make the claim. It doesn't guarantee what that claim will ultimately do, but it allows us to make the claim. This lady was a resident and a worker in St. Helens, Oregon. I believe that's why Representative Witt is here. It was one of his constituents, and I'm sure he has some thoughts also, but I'm here to answer any questions. But I think the two articles I gave you give you some really good insight as to why this law isn't fair. And I'll make one more point, and I'll stop talking about it. And Steve Dean, in his article, makes a really interesting analogy. If an independent person had come there, say a private contractor, and had simply been mowing the lawn, and he had been murdered, he could make this claim. But the fact that my lady's, the state that I represent, the fact that she was working for someone who covered her with workers' comp, she can't make that claim. And that's the fallacy in this law as it stands. Thank you.
And would you envision this law, Ms. Hagan, to only cover a murder victim? Or what if somebody, what if a worker fell off a building? Or because that's part of the complication you ran into with
right.
workers' compensation.
First of all, I do believe this would cover any wrongful death. I think it is that broad, to be perfectly frank. Again, it's a wrongful death. It would have to involve right. negligence or an intentional act.
Can I?
Yes. Senator Robles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would cover if the person had called up and said my washer wasn't working and they sent out a Maytag repair person, and that person was covered by his employer with workers' comp, it would cover that death.
It would absolutely, Senator. As a matter of fact, it would cover any person who's covered by workers' comp. And so we're clear here, my lady was not working for a government entity. She was not.
Oh, okay.
She was working, even though it says Columbia County Mental Health.
Right.
They're not a government entity.
Not probably. Okay.
But yes, exactly.
Any further questions? Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and House and Senate members of your respective committees. Thank you for this opportunity. You've heard already the facts of the case, and I had the opportunity to speak before the chairman's committee earlier in the session, and I just want to express my appreciation for all of you taking this issue up, because what we have here is a wrongful death, and we have a wrongful death without remedy. And I very much respect the need for exclusive remedy under workers' compensation system. I think of any member in the legislature, I probably have more experience working in the workers' comp arena. And I fully respect that. But we cannot devise...
Can you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31. My apologies. We cannot devise a system in this state of laws that preclude remedy. I mean, that is fundamentally unsound. It has been going back to the laws of England. And, I mean, that has been a precept of our system of jurisprudence. And there is no justice in this instance. And I believe that, as you have already heard, in those limited instances where there is a wrongful death claim, we need to make those precise kinds of allowances for folks to be able to pursue an adequate remedy. And I will assure you that this family's circumstances are such that the $15,000 plus or minus for funeral arrangements was simply not adequate. And I don't want to argue necessarily the individual circumstances of a particular family, but I am telling you that there is in no way nothing close to justice having been served in this instance. And when you have a situation where it was indeed wrongful and where folks were fully aware of the danger posed by the individual that committed the murder. When a coworker who was asked to go out and deliver the medication refused to go on that basis, and Jennifer ended up going and without any kind of legal accompaniment, it might have made sense, knowing the danger that was involved in this particular individual, to perhaps have had a member of the police force go out with her. When she's sent to do that job, knowing the danger, and she's murdered, we owe it to those who are left behind to be able to have adequate compensation and an adequate remedy, of which there is none presently. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, sorry. I might have a series, is that okay?
Yes,
thank
it
you.
Is, please.
Mr. Sahagian, so do you know what the recidivism rate is for people on PSRB?
I have literally no idea. I'm sorry, I don't have...
Okay.
I just don't. I don't know that.
Okay, thank you. And what is the recidivism rate for people leaving the state prison?
And, you know, I don't know. I just don't have that information.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, thank you. So would, if somebody was leaving the state prison and he left the state prison and Jennifer Warren was taking medication to him, would you expect that the prison system would, the correction system would be responsible for the claim?
Let me answer that in two ways. I don't think so. I don't, because again, don't forget that person has served their time. They're out now. They might be on some type of parole or probation with a parole officer, and I think it's up to the individual parole officer to figure out how dangerous is this person in the community. For example, a sex offender is going to have many more strings attached when they're on parole versus someone who got out for, say, a property crime. So let me take that one step further. Don't forget this person in this particular case was under the purview of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I mean, they made a conscious decision, and by the way, he was under their purview for 20 years.
I know that. If I may, Mr. Chair. So, but when someone is released, say they've committed a murder, manslaughter, whatever, and they're released from the criminal justice system into the community, mm-hmm. is there some assurance, do you think, that they would be responsible if that person recommitted a murder?
I think you have to look at the individual case. Did the people who are supervising them provide adequate supervision? That's the test. And
so has that happened in the past? Has the parole board been sued because they have released somebody or they're not doing adequate supervision?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, again, if we didn't have a situation where she wasn't covered by workers, she wasn't on the job, we wouldn't be here having this discussion.
But what I'm asking,
absolutely,
if I may.
Absolutely, parole board or probation officers have been sued for improper supervision. Absolutely. Usually it's with sex crimes. There's a sex offender out at inadequate supervision. They committed a sex crime, and that person sues the probation officer or the probation that county's in.
And has that suit been successful?
Absolutely.
And
matter of fact, I would suggest many times it just gets settled.
So how about a murder, which is similar to this?
Yeah. The short answer is yes. And again, don't feel like it comes down to it. That's what we're saying. All this does allow us to make the claim, and it's up to a jury question to decide.
Right. And so they can make that claim.
Absolutely.
Against the parole board.
And then the jury decides, was there proper supervision or not?
Right. But that claim can be made against the parole board.
And all we're doing here is allow the claim to be made and let a jury decide. Because they might say, you know what, the PSRB, they did an okay job. They took enough time, and that was good enough. I don't think that's true, but that's what they could decide.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the chance this morning or this afternoon.
Is there a representative from the Workers' Compensation Division here? Please go ahead and just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barker and Chair Przonski, members of the committee, my name is John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation System, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. At your request, I'm here to present information about the workers' compensation system, as well as fatality benefits that are available in the unfortunate circumstance that the worker is fatally injured or killed on the job. To be clear, I'm only addressing issues related to workers' compensation. So, to be very clear, a person who's injured in the course and scope of employment is automatically entitled to certain benefits that can range from wage replacement benefits, medical services for their injuries, rehabilitation services. In the case of a fatality, there's benefits to beneficiaries. More specifically, in a fatality, final disposition of the body and funeral expenses are paid up to $16,825 currently. If there's some of that money left over from the disposition of the body or the funeral, that's paid to the estate of the deceased. There's monthly benefits to a surviving spouse. There's beneficiary benefits to children that depend on their age and whether or not they're continuing education. Currently, the total family benefits in workers' compensation are limited to 4.35 times 133 1/3% of the state average weekly wage, or about $4,879 per month. Employers pay for and provide workers' compensation insurance, which you know is a no-fault insurance system. In relation to your discussion, I wanted to touch on a few important points. First of all, it's important to note that government employers are treated the same as private employers in workers' compensation. There's no difference. Employees basically have given up their right to sue their employer in order to receive the certain benefits that they receive in workers' compensation insurance. That's pretty much how systems of workers' compensation work around the world. The workers' compensation insurance is provided by or paid for by the employer, and if the injury happens in the course and scope of employment, then the benefits are provided. For that coverage of workers' compensation, the employer is provided with exclusive remedy for work-related injury or death. Without going into great detail about exclusive remedy, it's essentially that in most instances, the employer cannot be sued by the injured party. However, under Oregon law, currently, even in an accepted claim, there are instances where a worker or their beneficiaries, in the case of a fatality, can take legal action outside the workers' compensation system and sue the employer. And those include where the injury is caused by willful and unprovoked aggression of the employer, where the worker and the person that caused the harm are not engaged in the furtherance of a common enterprise or the accomplishment of the same or related objectives. Third, where the injury is caused by the failure of the employer to comply with a specific workplace safety requirement, what's known as red tagging of equipment by Oregon OSHA. Where the worker is compensably injured due to the negligence or wrong of a third person, such as where that third person isn't exempt through exclusive remedy and not in the same employ as the injured worker. So, and that example typically is an employee of another employer. And finally, this session, SB 678, has been passed, and if enacted, that will provide also a new avenue for creating when the negligence of a person is a substantial factor in causing the injury to the injured worker, and that negligence occurs outside the capacity that qualifies a person for exclusive remedy protection. So these third-party lawsuits, as they're known, are allowed currently, and they do happen. Please note that if the worker's lawsuit is successful, the workers' compensation insurance carrier is allowed to recoup some of their costs. And I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Representative,
thank you. Mr. Chair, so help me understand. This is all new to me. So help me understand. So we just heard from the previous witness that if Ms. Warren had been murdered by somebody who'd been on parole, that the parole board could have been sued for workers' comp. Is that right?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, I am not an expert outside of the workers' compensation law, so I'd probably be the worst person to answer that question. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, committee members, for the record, Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I also am the Administrator for the Management and Labor Advisory Committee. Chair Barker, you had issued a letter to the House Judiciary Committee on April 17th in regards to convening an interim work group focusing on resolving some of these issues. And so I've been asked to provide a report on that, in which there is not a whole lot to report. We're on the ground floor of putting this together. With the work group in general, they're beyond the setting up the parameters of what can be contained and discussed to lead up to legislation for 2014. Which is the ultimate goal of this work group, and determining who should be involved in the conversations beyond the Workers' Compensation Division, Mr. Zahagan, Representative Witt, and others. There's also the determination on who should staff and help shepherd the conversation. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has the statutory authority to look at issues that impact the workers' compensation system, but there are other issues such as the Torts Claims Act, public agency, sovereign immunity, others that are outside the scope of the committee. So that is one of the other factors that are in play. But the conversations are starting to begin, and we should be able to, well, I can't commit since the work group is not formalized yet, but we should be able to have some progress report to you during a future interim hearing.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from the committee? Okay, we appreciate your work on that. Thank you. Anything else?
I don't have anything else. I was going to say thank you to the members. We are, as you probably saw, Chair Barker and I are trying to get some of the potential items that might be part of our interim work together so we can kind of scope it now while we have everyone together. So I want to thank everyone that made it this afternoon. There will be some more scheduled for next week, and I believe we may have some the following week if everything comes together. Clearly, we need to get the participants that are needed to go forward. And I think the one thing that we both would like is if there's other topics that you have that we didn't catch, and please feel free to check in with the judiciary staff as to what's on the agenda as to topics for the next 2 weeks that we may be covering. And if there's something else, please let us know so we can see if it's something we can actually work into our schedule now. And then that will hopefully help facilitate when we get together during the interim meetings to be able to be more honed in on whatever the issues are and not starting from ground zero. But thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Okay, no further business before the committee. We're adjourned. Thank you again for coming today.
Hopefully we aren't in a position to schedule on any of this.